Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. It's going to be one of those musical and colorful mornings today here on the show. At 9:30, we're going to learn of another connection between Vermont and Cuba, this one of the musical variety. Then we'll meet Brooks Hubbard and Jess Raymond. They're going to be performing a special performance in White River Junction this Friday. And finally, we'll learn about why our trees are so happy to provide a Technicolor dream show for us every year. Now, though, it's your turn, listeners, to call in. Let me know what's been on your mind, where you've been spotting great foliage so far. And since it's a bit of a musical show, you can share any concerts you've been to in the past or recently that you want to tell us about. Our numbers are 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. We'll open up the phones till 9:30 this morning. First time in a couple of weeks we've had the phones open. Again, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And speaking of music, the Monkees are coming to your town later this month, Tuesday the 26th. They come to the Flynn in Burlington, and I am going. I have bought my ticket to go see the Monkees. Now, I grew up at a time when the show was on. We were massive Monkees fans in my neighborhood. And, you know, good or bad, I'd like to see the Monkees just once. So we did this thing in our neighborhood. There were four of us, four buddies who grew up. We're still friends. One's my brother and the other two, Dennis and Craig. And if a show would come on or a cartoon with superheroes, there was usually four of them, right? And we would pick out who we each were. I don't know if this was a thing any of you else did. Don't ask me how, why it started, but we would do that, right? Show would come on and, you know, after an episode or two, we would all claim to be one of the characters. So I was Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees. He was the drummer. And Mickey and Michael Nesmith are the two surviving band members. So I guess that's one of the reasons I want to go see him. Mickey's still alive. He's actually, I think, singing in the current day Monkees lineup. You know, it was old Davy Jones, the pretty boy from England, who was the Monkees lead singer. But it's now Mickey and Mike, who are still Michael, who are still alive. Peter Tork and Davy Jones, unfortunately, have passed away. All right, the phones are open, listeners. You can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can tell me your favorite Monkey. It's probably going to be Davy Jones. He was everybody's favorite Monkey. The three others, it was like Davy Jones and the other three, you know, but it was such a great show back then, you know, as you were a kid. And you know, they had some fabulous people writing their songs. I think Neil Diamond wrote, Carole King, different people like that were cranking out songs for the Monkees that they would perform. All right. Listeners, the phones are open, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. The other thing we're talking about is, of course, foliage season. Have you gotten out? I was up in Calais, Kent's Corners, a couple weekends ago, and they were just starting there. That's always such a lovely spot. You know, East Montpelier, driving those back farm roads. It's so New England, and you get some great, beautiful, foliage early on. And so, that was one spot that I got to see. All right. We're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Oh, the Duke of Newbury checks in early on a Monday morning. Fred, what's going on?
Let's see here. The the federal budget, I think, is going to be too big. We're spending too much money.
Yep.
And the more the federal government spends, that's going to put a big demand on resources. And right now, resources are not at the verge of collapse. But there are shortages out there, and I think it's going to cause more shortages. And shortages are going to increase prices. So this is going to be a big cycle of increasing prices and decreasing resources. That's what I think. And I don't know if it's going to work out.
Yeah, your point is well taken. Right now there are a lot of shortages. Now, we are in the this free enterprise system. And I'll just throw this out there. You know, right now the shortages seem to be more because of labor. Hopefully the labor market, eventually flows back, and does help us end some of these shortages that are caused by a low labor market. But the American free enterprise system, you always fill into a void, right, Fred? So, I'm not saying what you're saying is wrong. You're probably right. But the American free enterprise system is that if there's a void, you rush to fill it because that's where the money can be made. And the idea is, as these shortages exist, someone will step in and fill those voids. Now, is the infrastructure there to fill those voids is probably a question that needs to be asked as well. Will the labor market return? People have found during this pandemic, they're kind of enjoying a little time off or finding that they don't have to work quite as much or, in the positions they had. You paint a picture of some gloom. Now, where's the positive side for you, Fred? How does it, I said it could rectify itself. How do you see it, possibly working out in a positive way? I'm going to throw it back to you.
The positive way would be the government's going to have to stay out of it.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government can't get into it. Is what's happened now is the Fed got into the money supply and now there's so much money sloshing around at the end, nobody knows what to do.
Yeah.
Okay, so what do you do with You put it in the stock market. That's why the stock market is so high. Mm-hmm. The stock market wouldn't be high if there wasn't all this money out there because the banks are only paying, four basis points interest.
Right. Yep.
So the federal government has got to stay out of it and let the damn private economy do the work that it has to do, and that is through the free economic system that we have, they're going to have to get it back together again. We don't need the government yet. I mean, the president wants to put, billions of dollars into the economy?
Trillions.
I mean, trillions of dollars into the economy, right? Yep. And I mean, we've already got enough money in the economy. We don't need any more money in the economy.
Yeah, I mean, during the pandemic, as the economy suffered, you certainly goose it with, an influx. But when do you hit the brakes or decelerate on flooding the economy with more money? Excellent question. Excellent points this morning, Fred, the Duke of Newbury. Always great to hear from him. Let's go to Montpelier. We've got Stephen. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. Good morning, Rick.
Morning.
I have a question and a comment.
Yeah.
And my question is whether Chubby Checker is still alive. And my comment is that years ago, he taught the twist at the Peppermint Lounge in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I learned he taught me how to do the twist years ago.
You're kidding me. Wow.
No?
That is so cool. Now, I lived in Miami. The Peppermint Lounge was long gone before I got there. So do you know where the Peppermint Lounge was?
No, I don't.
Okay. All right. Danny, our director, says that Chubby Checker, you can still take, apparently, we'll see what shape he's in, but you might still be able to learn the twist from him. He's 80 years old. And his birthday, Stephen, his birthday was yesterday. He's a little upset that you didn't send him a card. All right. So, what was it like learning the twist from Chubby Checker. Was he up on stage and there was just, you know, you guys were in the audience?
Yeah, everybody was dancing around in the audience.
Oh, my gosh. How cool. Wow. My gosh. And so where were you living at the time? Were you on vacation in Miami or?
Yes, I was visiting a friend from summer camp who had a place in Miami, and I just was visiting.
All right. So you're where were you living at the time? In Vermont or elsewhere?
I was living at the time in Connecticut.
Okay. So when you got back to the Nutmeg State with this equipped with the twist, were you like the coolest person in your town because you knew
I have to be totally honest, I was never cool. Oh, and I have one more thing to say.
Go ahead, Steve.
I would like to suggest, you know, we have a state bird and we have a state fish, and I think we need a state joke. And here's my joke. It's quite clean.
All right.
The question is, why do cows have hooves instead of feet?
Why do cows have hooves instead of feet?
Because they lactose.
Because they lactose. yeah, Stephen, keep your day job. we'll see who we talk to see if we can make that the state joke. It's actually quite funny. I hear some mooing out in the fields right now from the cows that are listening to DEV. So, all right, there's Stephen's first and only joke, and it might, just might, become the state joke. Thanks, Stephen, for calling in. All right. Let's see. If you've been to a great spot for leaf peeping, hey, let us know about it. You've been there. Now share it with somebody else. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And of course, if you're like Fred, you can bring up, you know, the economy or anything else you want to talk about. Oh, wait, let's see here. Do we have somebody? Oh, I missed that one. Here we go. Dwight in Burlington says, we were camping in West Burke this past weekend, not far from where we are here. We hiked up Mount Pisgah. Oh, West Burke. I'm sorry, over on the, yeah, in the Northeast Kingdom. All right. Hiked up Mount Pisgah next to Lake Willoughby. Yeah, that's wonderful. Foliage, good but not great. Lots of leaves already starting to fall. Locals said the drought is still on and affecting the leaves. So that's Dwight in Burlington, was up in the Kingdom, and good but not great. We'll find out this morning at 10:30 from Abby Vandenberg from UVM's Proctor Center for Maple Research about why they change colors. She might not necessarily give us the foliage report. That's really not her gig, but we'll learn why they change colors, which is always kind of an age-old question, and I'm not going to pretend to know the answer. So, all right, we're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. It is a musical morning. Tony Basanta is going to be in here next with me. He has a show called Havana Fairfax Connection on Lake Champlain Access Television. And we'll hear from him about what he's doing. Just got a nice award for that TV show. At 10 o'clock, Brooks Hubbard will be on, his Brooks Hubbard Band, along with Jess and Jacob. And Jess Raymond from Jess and Jacob will be on. They've got a show down in White River Junction this Friday. And Jess and Jacob actually have a group that puts together shows in the Valley. It's called Here in the Valley. So they have been putting on some things in the Upper Valley. We'll hear what they're what they've got in mind and about this Friday show. And that is at the Briggs Opera House in White River Junction. That's a place I've not been to yet here in the state. All right, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And really need you to jump in and talk because it sounds like my voice is already going here on Monday morning. A show that I was to recently in Burlington. So Burlington City Arts has this new space down on Pine Street, and they've been putting on some Saturday night shows in the back of it. I think it's called like 405 Outback or something. But that venue, I saw Martin Sexton, and what a crooner he is. A wee man with a big voice, and it was a fabulous show outside on a Saturday night. He was just so jazzed to be back in Vermont and Burlington. You know, it feels like this is a place that he really feels comfortable in. He's from upstate New York originally, I believe. But that was a pretty fabulous show. I know Higher Ground has Robin Hitchcock coming in a couple weeks. That one's circled. That's somebody I'll probably go see. And like I said, at the Flynn on that Tuesday night, the 26th. Yeah, 26th. The Monkees are coming in. And yeah, I'm just a sucker for that. I have to go see the Monkees when they come in. It's still Mickey Dolenz, Michael Nesmith are the two who are left, and we'll see how they do. I mean, they have a band backing them up, and I've noticed with you know, older acts when I've gone to see them, like a band called Straubs from England or Dave Davies from the Kinks. I got to see over in New Hampshire a couple years ago, and whatever they're having a little problem with. You know, someone will, tend to, be, you know, on stage, who can maybe duet with them or, pick up parts of whatever they used to play, where they can't quite, can't quite make it. I mean, the Monkees have been around. It was like 50 years ago that they were on TV or something. So, you know, they have aged and they're not going to be quite as good. But I have also found that in these types of shows, the audience is really understanding. You kind of see and hear a lot of what you remember and a lot less of what you're seeing on stage, you know, somebody who's pretty old. I mean, look at the Stones, man. They're still going. And, you know, although I think they have weathered it pretty well. Not Keith, of course, but, you know, he was born looking that old and being that old. All right, we've got open phones for about five more minutes. We're talking music, leaves, or whatever you'd like, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. If you've got a state joke that you think can top Stevens, boy, I hate to do that because Stephen is really primed to have that to be the state joke. I don't want to turn this into a competition. There was a rabbi in southern Vermont. Anybody remember this? I'm going to say this is about 5, 6, 7 years ago when the Pope was looking for a joke. The Pope was looking for a joke, and I think the one that got chosen throughout the entire world was written by a Pope, a rabbi slash comedian from southern Vermont. And it was along the lines of our friend Stephen's joke. It was, you know, the same, had that same wow factor that we heard from Stephen. Yeah. Why do cows have hooves? Because they lack toes. There we go. All right. Don't make me do my jokes here. All right. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email, if you've, seen, some great foliage or not great. We did hear from Dwight in Burlington who said, they were over in West Burke, went up to Mount Pisgah, Lake Willoughby. Good, but not great foliage. Although, that's not where it hasn't peaked yet, from what I understand throughout most of the state. Just a few spots where it's peaked. So I think, Dwight, we might actually still have something good on the way. We will see. All right, let's see. We're going to go to the phones, back to the phones, and it is Jane who's going to save the day from Roxbury. What's going on in Roxbury, Jane?
Well, not a whole lot, but the foliage is absolutely glorious on 12A from Northfield down to Randolph. I just drove down through there. It is just every year. Probably one of the prettiest places.
Wow. 12A, Northfield down to Randolph. Oh, that's a great drive, yeah. Too. I love that.
Yeah. Well, it's beautiful this morning, even though it's a little foggy and dreary.
Yeah. All right. Well, if our leaf peeping friends who are visiting the state have not, you know, found a rich vein of color, Jane in Roxbury says, here you go. Hit 12A.
Got it.
Northfield to Randolph. And, yeah, that is a lovely part of the state and putting on a show for us right now. How great is that?
It's also a good bike.
Oh, you can bike it as well?
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful. It's flat. The road was repaved a couple of years ago. It's my daily bike.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. All right. So if you're a cyclist, that's a great way to do it as well. Northfield to Randolph or vice versa, I guess. Hit 12A.
Yeah,
if you're in the south,
12A.
Come on up from one to the other. And, boy, you know, in Northfield, you get to see the lovely campus of Norwich University. I just love it. It's one of my favorite campuses in New England. So that's there. Of course, Randolph has some great things to see. So what a neat recommendation from Jane. All right, Jane, be careful on that bike as you're riding around. I hope you're not calling while you're riding, but
No, I'm sitting waiting to go to the swimming pool at Vermont Tech, actually.
Oh, good for you. All right, get in a swim this morning. Thanks so much, Jane. All right, take care. All right, there you go. Jane's got you covered. And you can get to that area from just about anywhere in the state. Maybe if you're up in the great Northwest Kingdom, that's a little tough. But Northfield to Randolph, Route 12A, great place to see some of the beautiful foliage that we offer. All right, we're going to take a break, and then that'll do it for the open phones. Coming up, we're going to have some fun learning about the Havana-Fairfax connection. And the Sox are off tonight, but the season is not over. We've got them again tomorrow against the Yankees. It's the wild card playoff game. So that means tonight a full dose of the Brady Farkas Show, followed by Dinner Jazz with the jazz man himself, John Wilson. And this is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. There was a time when Vermont and Cuba had a real connection. We once shipped Holsteins and Jersey Heffords to the island nation. Armando Villaseca, Vermont's one-time education commissioner, was Cuban-American. And while it was still in business, Burlington College established a study abroad program with the University of Havana. There are still some connections. In Colchester, there's an out-of-the-home business called Miami Mommy that sells Cuban food. And on Lake Champlain Access Television, there's a program that is a carnival of music, happiness, joy, and very danceable tunes. It's called Havana Fairfax Connection. It's hosted by Tony Basanta, and he joins us now. Tony, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, I am very glad. I'm very happy to be here. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for the invitation.
Sure.
I am glad to also be listening to that great music here.
Yeah, tell us what we just heard.
This is Magic Place. Magic Place is a composition of Alfredo Chacon, who is a vibist, who's now playing the iwi. So that's another sound that you listen in that recording. And that was a great live show in Miami. They are all Cubans there, and Carlos Piggis on the flugelhorn, Nestor de Prado is on bass, and other people that I don't know because they are very young.
Yeah.
But that was a great opening, and Julio Fowler is on vocals, doing those vocales that he loves a la Manhattan Transfer.
Oh, yeah.
So that was a good opening. And I began thinking of that show after listening to his album Magic Place that he recorded in Madrid a few years ago. And then I put some of the new musicians, that's what I call it, Seas of Change.
Because
they have brought a change in the music, chamber music, rock, rock jazz fusion, danzones with Alejandro Falcón and more.
Nice. All right, listeners, if you'd like to talk to Tony about the music he plays, or if you regularly watch the show, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255, the email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. So when someone watches Havana-Fairfax Connection, what will they see and hear when they tune in?
Well, I have tried to give the broadest presentation of music. My first band in this show that began in June 2017 was a band from Burlington, that is Maud Barber. I just saw them playing at the Skinny Pancake in Burlington, and in just one call they came to a show and they play all in one set.
Wow.
So that was the opening. And then I have been alternating with videos that I brought from Cuba, others that I have got here from musicians like Christian Howe, who is a violinist from Cleveland, who lives in New York, and he made a great show in Spain with a jazz quartet of Argentinians and Americans. That is great. So also we have had a lot of locals. Let's say I have filmed several times in the jazz festival. We have had Paul Asbel Quartet and other people, which are really amazing. And then we had Deb Bryson and the Hay Burners. That is a band from the Addison County. And it has been one of the most watched episodes through the website of the channel. And also, let's say, Feliciano Arango, the bass player of NG La Banda, that has been one of those great shows. And then now we have 92 episodes.
Wow.
We were a little bit slow because of the pandemic that affected everything. So we haven't had many live bands in the studio, but Navi Reid has come 6 times.
Navi Reid.
Yeah, with a different lineup. So I made the Navi Reid project Reloaded. So every time that they came, we had a different lineup with 4 or 5 guitarists, trombone, harps, good singers.
Yeah.
So it's been good.
Let me tell people that you can catch the past episodes at LCA. It's Lake Champlain Access Television, lcatv.org, and they are there, and they are wonderful. I understand the Havana part, but what is the Fairfax part of Havana-Fairfax Connection?
Well, I was born in Havana, but I live now in Fairfax.
Ah, there we go.
I have been living there since, since the end of 2016. And then I began hosting this show with Rebecca Padula, who is the channel coordinator. She's a musician, too, and a wonderful player. And she has been, well, half the heart of the show because she's the sound engineer. She's the editor, so she does part of that show. So this award belongs to her, too.
So you got here in 2016, started the show in 2017. Not much.
I arrived in 2006.
Ah, there
we
go.
And in 2016, I went to live in Fairfax.
I got you. Okay. But why and, you know, did you get this show started?
Well, I really was doing a radio show first at UVM, WRUB. That was when I arrived in 2006, thanks to David Garten, who is a photographer in Waysville. He knew L.J. Pallardi. So they invited me to the show. I was just arriving, and I had an experience of more than 20 years in the Cuban radio.
Yeah.
So they said, well, would you like to make a show while you are here? I said, well, that's wonderful. So I began doing peanut butter and jelly. It was a substitution to LJ and Duncan Fletcher. And then they gave me the great yarding, so I was doing a show from 4 to 6 a.m. And after that, I began doing global warming.
Yeah.
That was more like a global warning. But I began playing a lot of music, and I discovered many great bands from Vermont, and I went to see them live. For instance, Jimmy T and Tim Briggs. All those guys have been in my radio show and my TV show, too. And then I hosted a show, Sabroso Guarapo. Delicious sugar cane juice. That is a Cuban salmon tuna. And that was at the Radiator.
Yeah.
My dear friends at the Radiator. They were listening to me at UVM, so one day I transferred. And then I also had on Thursdays in the afternoons at St. Michael's College, where I am still for 11 years. Yesterday I had a show, my second show after the COVID. And I have been playing a lot of music, and I have been a guest of George B. Thomas at Vermont Public Radio.
Oh, George Thomas.
That was 4 hours of Cuban jazz.
Yeah.
That was amazing. And also in Warren with Tim Seniff.
Yeah.
That I have been there sometime. He came to pick me up and took me because I don't think that I would be able to reach Warren by myself.
I think that's where George Thomas is doing his show now, down in Warren there at that station. A decade ago, Tony, the connections to Cuba were rather evident. We also saw at the time, you know, more Latin culture in Vermont. There were groups doing like samba and other dances. You know, is there still a strong Latin influence in Vermont now?
Yeah.
Other than you?
Oh, yeah, sure. I remember my first experience was with Wawa, that I even played cowbell with them in one restaurant one night. It was just a few minutes in a song that I enjoyed a lot, and there were many dancers there. And we also had Afinque. That is a band by Scott Dean, the conga player. Ah. That is a band that has very great player. And they say Andy Severian on the piano. They have many different bands that they play together with Barica.
Right, sure.
So, I mean, they play all together. And then I have seen also a Grupo Sabor that had Rick Davis. It's the band by Dominicano Vermonter, whose name is Alejandro.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is more. And now we have Daniel Gaviria, that his wife and him have a wonderful duo. Gaviria was in my show with Cynthia Brayren Band, playing the guitar. And we took a chance to celebrate the National Hispanic Heritage Month because he's from Colombia and I am from Cuba. So that was beautiful. But I think that there is more. There is more. And we have Ray Vega playing trumpet, and he has the Wednesdays at the Hotel Vermont. So there is jazz in Vermont every week. I don't know if they are doing it now. I haven't gone there for a long time. But he has created two or three bands that I think that with all his knowledge and experience of being a member of many important bands in America, he has been teaching also at UVM because he's a professor there at the music department.
I don't want to roll all kind of Latin-influenced music in together. What is it that separates, that is distinctive about Cuban music?
Well, the thing about Cuban music mainly is the rhythm, the beat. They say Santana is from Mexico, but he has always had a lot of Cubans playing with him.
Mm-hmm.
Armando Peraza,
Oreste
Pilato, who are two big names. Armando Peraza unfortunately died, but Oreste Pilato has been one of the greatest timbaleros and bongos player. In the West Coast, there is a lot of music from Cuba, and there are many Cubans playing there now, not only in New York. But also in Florida, we have Chacon, we have Carlos Puig, and we have many other bands. We have Jose Gola. He's right, Gola Jose, but he was the bass player of Arturo Sandoval and Gonzalo Rubalcaba.
Ah.
So we have Chucho living in Florida now, Chucho Valdez. We have Paquito de Rivera. We have Arturo Sandoval. There are many people. Carlos Averoff, father, senior, who unfortunately died, but he was one of the horns of the first generation of Irakere. He was a teacher and a player in Florida. So there are many others.
Yeah.
There are many others.
It's interesting when you're back in Miami, you just can't help. The music of Cuba is just – it immerses you, right? Even if you're on the street, people driving down the street have their radios on, and you just have to kind of move, right?
And there are other three big names that I won't let to forget. Willie Chirino,
mm-hmm.
who is one of the pioneers making this music there and making the whole world dancing. Carlos Oliva y Los Sobrinos del Juez, the nephews of the judge. That is a song by Sammy Davis Jr.
Mm.
So they got that name more than 30 years ago. They are the creator, the real creators of the Miami sound.
Yeah,
is Carlos Oliva, a great singer. And we also have Gloria Estefan and Miami Sound Machine.
Course.
Nestor Torres, the flutist.
Right, yeah.
He's from Puerto Rico, but he played with Cachao in all the master sessions.
Hmm. All right, Tony, this one, what are we hearing now coming
in? We are
in?
Listening to Alejandro Falcón. He's a great piano player that has played from Matanza, where he was born, in Havana. He studied and he graduated at the University of the Arts, ISA. And he has been so far as Paris or Egypt. He's a great player, wonderful musician, wonderful person. And he made an album, as he was born in Matanzas, that is the cradle of the Cuban dance song, that is Cuba's national dance. He has been fusing all that with jazz and more. So he has a great recordings, and this is Cuba Now Dance Song. So it's the dance song at the moment, because some people say that it is fade music and all, but it's not. This is the basis of Latin jazz.
Yeah.
So people, because, oye, ¿cómo va? Tito Puente. It came out of Chanchullo by Cachaos. So Tito made it a big symphony, and then Santana in the rock side. So that comes from the dance song.
Nice.
So Arturo Sandoval, when he arrived in Cuba, the first album that he recorded was Dance On. But he write Dance On in English. So, but that was a dance song. Not all dance on record, because there is a lot of music there. But that is... And these are the younger people. La Joven Jazz Band is in that band. Falcón used to play the piano. Now they have younger player, because he's making a meteoric career, playing also with La Academia, that is a band by Ruy López Nosa. Mm-hmm. And he has his own band that is named Claro Oscuro. So he's doing great. But he always collaborate, and this is wonderful.
Where are you from in Cuba?
I am from Havana.
You are from Havana.
Yeah. I was born in a border of football players, soccer players.
Ah.
That is named Puentes Grandes, Big Bridges.
I love that.
So there I learned my first things about music.
Oh, my gosh. And I saw you. I mean, you must play some...
A little bit, but I was really mainly a singer.
No kidding.
I used to sing in a rock band when I was 14.
Yeah.
With my friends. One of them is now in my episode number 90, Omar Pitaluga, who lives in Hialeah, Florida. He's a great rock player. And I used to sing with them. We made some parties, and then I became a professor. He became a guitarist. Mm. But I have been always involved. I was married to a pianist for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I began playing little minuets by Mozart. That's what I sometimes move my hands like.
I see
pianist.
That, yeah. What was the name of the rock band that you were in way back when?
Here in the television?
No, when you were 14.
I have one band that was Sand Tops and Stars. I copied that name from the Reader Digest. Arenas Cumbres y Estrellas. Because, we were in the sand and we were also in the sun. So that's
love
why
it.
I got that name.
Now, Tony, even though you're based here in Vermont, I would think that you've got people tuning in from other areas. Where do you hear from people outside of Vermont who are watching your show, Havana Fairfax Connection?
We have had many reviews in Paris, in Rome, in Chile, in Japan, because I hosted a show that had to do with a Japanese percussionist whose name is Haruhiko Kono. He had been living in Havana for more than 30 years. Mm. He was a member of Diakara, that is a band created by the singer of Ira Kere. So Oscar was his teacher, but he began learning to play congas in Japan with the conga player of one of the greatest bands from Japan, that is the Tokyo Cuban Boys, got the name from the Lecuona Cuban Boys. They introduced the mambo in Asia. So Haruhiko Kono began playing there. He did not speak Spanish when he came to Cuba, but he began to learn the language of the drums. Mm. So now he speaks very good Spanish. With his Japanese accent, like me, my Japanese, my Cuban, but he speaks very well. And he
you have a Cuban
everything.
Accent?
Yeah,
we
a
didn't
little
notice.
Bit.
All right. Now, I do want to bring this up because in addition to people watching your show from all around the world, which just that's incredible, is you were recently honored. So tell us about the award that you got.
Well, this is I'm really so proud of this, and I want to dedicate this award to all the musicians who have been in my radio, my TV shows.
Yeah.
Because this is an award that I learned it from a guitarist from Cuba who is a rock player who lives in Rome. His name is René Soler Pedraza. He played with a band named Los Watts in the 60s. Well, he married to a woman from Greece, so he left very soon from Cuba. And he said, "Hey, Tony, why don't you compete? You have a TV show." I say, "Oh, René, but I don't play any instruments. What am I going to send?" "Send them a copy of your television show." So that's what I did. And it is gold, silver, and I got the silver medal.
Yeah.
And the bronze, too, because there are musicians from all over the world. So I am in a list of more than 100 people. Maybe there are very few hosts of radio and television. But I had to explain them, no, my CDs, no, those are DVDs of television shows. So when they watch it, they say, "Oh, man, this is surprising."
Yeah.
So, I was expecting this in 2020, but I discovered it very recently, at the end of July probably. So I wanted to spread the news and say thank you to all the people here, all the band that have been in my show, up to the last one.
Yeah. It's a really neat show, and it's a great way for people to be exposed to this music. It's called Havana Fairfax Connection. What do you hope that people will learn and enjoy when they watch your show?
Well, first, the connection is to bring all the great artists of this beautiful state. That is one. And also not to be centralized in one kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
I have been hosting recently two concertos for the piano written by the great Brazilian composer Heitor Villa-Lobos. That was a wonderful work of art by Ulises Hernandez, who is a Cuban pianist, and he's a great producer. Now he's the director of the Havana Mozarteum. So this concert were recorded a few years ago. Now I had the possibility to show it to the people in the United States of America via Vermont. And we have had chamber music, lots of concert. I will hold soon the Apollo Chamber Players. That is a band that plays like symphonic rock with a chamber group, which is amazing.
Oh,
I would like to share that album with you. They sent me a copy very recently and said, oh, yes, you go. We have seen your show. We would like to be there, too. And there are others. They say there are many people here. The Burlington Chamber Orchestra, I would like to have them in the studio because I saw them playing with Ray Vega at UVM, and that was a great combination of a Latin jazz group with a chamber orchestra. And they played themselves few pieces that I was surprised of the quality of the composers and the players.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just sitting here watching you go. Your mind is just exploding. We only have about a minute and a half left. But, you know, where did all this musical knowledge come from? You are a storehouse of musical knowledge.
Well, mainly reading, mainly watching, and also listening. When I was a very young lad, maybe 10, 11 years of age, my father always paid me a teacher of English at home.
Mm-hmm.
So to practice more, I listened to WQAM from Miami.
Yeah.
I began listening to Fleetwood Knight, Joy to the World. But mainly reading. And then here I read the 7 days every week.
Yeah.
And just to know more where I cannot go, at least I can read about them. And in Havana, Cuba, where I was studying at the university, I was part of the mass choir of my university. That was a pedagogical university. I was also playing in a Latin American music group. We played music from Chile, like Victor Jara songs and La Nueva Trova Cubana. Then going to all the concerts. I saw bands from Germany, Denmark, Norway, Japan, and Cuba. I went to all the concerts.
You exposed yourself to all that music,
and
it really shows now. Tony Bessante hosts Havana Fairfax Connection. It's on Lake Champlain Access Television. And listeners, you can see all the episodes at lcatv.org. Tony, been a pleasure hearing about your show and your love of music. Thank you so much for being here.
I am honored to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation.
All right. News is next. Then we'll be back to talk more music. We're going to hear from musicians Jess Raymond and Brooks Hubbard about a show coming up this Friday in White River Junction. And speaking of music, today at 1 o'clock, it's a full 3 hours of The Getaway with Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. This Friday, there will be a special concert going on at the Briggs Opera House in White River Junction. It will be a homecoming of an Upper Valley singer-songwriter who's been living in Nashville for the past 6 years. Brooks Hubbard will perform with his band, and Jess and Jacob will open up for them. Joining me to talk about the return is Brooks Hubbard. Brooks, thanks for being here on Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Good morning.
Morning. We also have Jess Raymond of the band Jess and Jacob and the organization here in the Valley that's putting on this show. Jess, thank you for being here as well.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. Listeners, if you'd like to ask our guests a question or if you're a fan of their work, you can call us 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jess, give us some of the details of what's happening Friday night there in White River Junction.
Yeah, so we're having a concert at the Briggs Opera House, which is a great room for music, and the show starts at 6:30, the doors are at 6, and we're also live streaming it. Over the last year, we've been working up a crew who has gotten really good with their cameras, and we're going to be live streaming that, so you can see the show live in person, or you can watch it online with a multi-camera stream.
Brooks, you're a Vermonter who's made his way off to Nashville over these past several years. What have you been doing there? Tell us what's been going on with you and your career.
So I actually have to make a correction. I'm from New Hampshire, but I love Vermont. I don't see any difference personally, but so I've been down in Nashville for the past 6 years, doing the music thing and being closer to the industry. And my wife and I moved back to the Upper Valley region this summer because we kind of realized I can do music from anywhere, and go off and keep the connections and all that stuff. We just love it up here as far as raising a family and all that stuff. So it's good to be back home.
Well, what was Nashville like? I mean, it is kind of the focal point now for a number of different musical genres. So how was it living there for 6 years?
It was great. I would say it was like going to college, getting, a master's degree in trying to figure out the music business. I still haven't figured it out. Yeah.
Well, you have figured out you can do it from anywhere. And
exactly.
No offense to New Hampshire, but if we find a good New Hampshire resident, we like to claim for our own over here in Vermont. So now, Jess, the show on Friday night is put on by the organization that you and Jacob run, I believe, called Here in the Valley. So tell us what that is.
Yeah, so we started Here in the Valley. We also went away. I grew up in White River, and then I went out to the West Coast. I lived in Seattle for about 15 years, and then moved back a couple of years ago. And we wanted to start something that we had been touring full time, and we came back to start a family too. And so the Here in the Valley idea started with maybe we'll just bring some of these great musicians that we know to us, so we don't have to go out on tour. They can come to us here in the valley. And so that's how it started. And then we had held a few concerts, a series of about two a year for a couple of years. And then we had a pandemic, and everyone might be aware.
Yes, we are.
and so while we couldn't do while we couldn't perform or have live music, the Briggs Opera House kind of opened its doors to us and let us workshop this idea of creating a live stream space. And so we started putting on shows, live streaming shows that were a combination of film work from local filmmakers and musicians, and we had to get everything remotely, and then we would do a show with no audience in the theater, but the crew and Jacob and I, but we would involve the community through outreach over the course of the month while we built it. And it was really fun. It was really successful. We learned a lot. And now our kind of next phase is kind of combining that with our original vision of bringing artists that we love and admire and putting on shows where we play together and have some, just try to build the scene of music here in the Valley.
And there will be a live audience and a live stream this Friday night.
Yeah, right? so now we're bringing it all back together. The audience is back, and we're keeping the stream.
Brooks Hubbard, what does it mean to you to be able to come back and play at the Briggs Opera House this Friday night in front of the home crowd?
It's kind of like a full circle thing. I don't know. I think it's gonna mean something more when it actually happens. But as far as looking forward right now, it's a homecoming. This area has always supported my music and Jess's music, and I'm sure she feels the same way, that we come from a special place, and it's great to celebrate that.
Tell us about your band. Who's in the Brooks Hubbard band?
Yeah, so my friend Justin Kimball, who I went to UMass Lowell with in the music department, he's a bass player, and he is the reason why I moved down to Nashville 6 years ago. So we actually had a band together for the last 3 years with our friend Nate Mold, called the Brooks Hubbard Band. And the pandemic and kind of burning ourselves out sort of has put that on a halt for a little bit. I'm doing more solo stuff now, but when this the opportunity of the show came about, I really wanted to get some top-rated players and friends of mine that live down in Nashville, based in Nashville. So this guy, Aaron Nelson, our friend Aaron Nelson, is playing drums. He plays with a terrific Americana singer-songwriter named Ian No. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lead guitar player, our friend Drew Smithers, who was formerly in this band called the Bishop Gunn. They were based out down south. He plays with J-Mo and friends now from the Allman Brothers Band.
Wow.
So some heavy hitters coming up and into the Upper Valley. It's going to be a good time.
Jess, how has it been for artists to play to, on these virtual, casts, these streams without an audience, and then to be able to play in front of people again?
Oh, man. doing the live streams is weirdly hard. without an audience, it's weirdly nerve-wracking, because you don't have any of that like immediate feedback, and so we ended up going a lot more scripted for the live streams, we had a lot of fun with each other. We had our crew, and So there was some excitement to it, and it was really fun. But then when things opened up a little bit this summer, June was just wonderful. And, it felt like getting back in front of people was, it was pretty emotional.
As someone on the other side, it's so great to be able to be in an audience again and to see live music. Brooks, we're going to go into the break. We're going to listen to one of your songs. It Was Us. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so this is a song. So down in Nashville, the regular 9-to-5 job is writing songs, which seems like a crazy thing that you can actually do for a living.
But, yeah.
This song came out of one of those co-writes, with my friend Mason Lee. And basically we met on a Tuesday or something, at 10 a.m. and had coffee and wrote this song. And we're thinking about some things and feeling the same things.
All right. We're going to listen to Brooks Hubbard, It Was Us. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
And I offer you my coat out in the snow. You put it on and said, I know where to go. Come on, boy, it's time for you to take me home.
Take me home.
And in the car, we sang Brown-Eyed Girl and Counted Stars. We took it easy, we didn't get too far. Just drove back roads sipping wine out of a mason jar. It was a comet flying high across the midnight sky. It was a river fire burning low. A shot of whiskey burning slow was enough. It was love and it was us. Stay alone in our bed some days. We made love until we couldn't stay awake. And yeah, that's the kind of stuff that you can't fake. It was your comet flying high across the midnight sky. It's a fire burning low. A shot of whiskey burning slow. It was enough. It was love and it was
us. We've waited for the opportunity to enjoy live music again. And this Friday at the Briggs Opera House in White River Junction, you'll have the opportunity with the Brooks Hubbard Band and what we're listening to now, Jess and Jacob. Brooks Hubbard and Jess Raymond are with me for a few more minutes. Listeners, to ask them a question or share a comment, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. That is Brown Bird by Jess and Jacob. And Jess Raymond, tell us about your band, Jess and Jacob.
Well, my name is Jess and my husband's name is Jacob. and so we toured, we had a band for about 10 years. It's called the Blackberry Bushes String Band, which is a mouthful and a whole lot to type into a URL. And when we moved back to Vermont, we just decided to simplify it a little bit and have it just be, just kind of focus more on just us. And so, We just went with Jess and Jacob because it was the easiest thing that we could agree on. We sometimes play a fun game called Jessica comes up with band names and Jacob just says, no.
Any really terrible ones you'd like to share with us now that, that he killed?
Oh, so many.
All right. Well, he plays fiddle. You play guitar, right? And sing in the band?
Yeah, Jacob is a wonderful fiddle player, and he also plays the upright bass. And I play the guitar and clawhammer banjo, and we both sing, and we have a good time together.
All right, and Jess and Jacob will be opening up for the Brooks Hubbard Band this Friday at the Briggs Opera House, White River Junction. You know, Brooks, for those who haven't been to the Briggs Opera House, what can you tell us about this venue, why you like to play there?
Well, it's certainly got a historical, piece to it, which I'm not sure on the entire history. I just, White River Junction in general is, you feel that, that kind of turn of the century sort of, thing. And, it's a special place. I haven't played there in a few years. So I think with it being, you know, like a homecoming show, it's really going to feel like I'm officially back in the area. I'm excited about that.
That is great. As we mentioned earlier, Brooks from New Hampshire just moved back to the area from Nashville after about 6 years down there. Jess and Jacob, Jess originally from the area, moved out to the West Coast, now living back here, and they've created something called Here in the Valley, which has put on all kinds of neat things. One of them is a Tuesday jukebox. Jess, what's that about?
Oh, yeah. So the Tuesday jukebox was kind of an offshoot during the pandemic, but we bring a band in, and that's actually a project that Jacob leads up most of the time, and he does some, he's a witty interviewer, so he does some interviewing, and he will usually sit in with the band, and we just kind of focus on one artist project, and it's kind of a shorter show midweek, just getting our Tuesday fix.
And can people attend that, or is it all virtual?
Well, it's a series, so people could attend it, yes. And we did have a few people at that during the last series. I think that will come back probably this winter we'll probably bring that series back. And it was a lot of fun. And we had both some traveling bands, and we're hoping that as touring opens back up again more, that we'll be getting some more of the bands that are making their way up the corridor here.
Mm-hmm.
And then also highlighting some of the really amazing artists that live right here. So
now, Brooks Hubbard, this Friday night show, like you said, this is kind of a homecoming, but what can people who attend expect from you? What will they be hearing?
Well, this is a new band, so they can expect a fresh sound. And I think our goal is just to celebrate with everybody the fact that we can do this again, which is really exciting. And it's cool that we're able to live stream it so that anybody can attend, you know, whether they feel uncomfortable to be there or they're too far away. So I think that's exciting in itself.
It's an early start, Jess. You know, I think doors at 6, show at 6:30. I went to a show in Boston a few years ago for the band called Belly, and they had a 6:30 show, and it was because the band wanted to quit and get home as early as they could. any reason for the early start time of this Friday show?
I think it's just the idea is get everyone in, have a good time, and we also, not that I want to quit. It's not a matter of quitting, but I do have a 4-year-old.
Yeah.
So.
I'm not complaining. As a matter of fact, I love the earlier shows, and I think it's great that, in my youth, there were shows that didn't get started till, 11 or even midnight sometimes, right? And I'm not there anymore. So what other performances, Jess, are you hoping to put on here in the Valley?
Yeah. So we're hoping to, keep the Here in the Valley show. We'll hopefully start up again. We're hoping to do a start with a holiday show this winter, and that show is kind of a collaboration between, we feature some professional artists, and then we also work with on some collaborative projects with local amateur artists, and it's really a lot of fun. And I actually just got a Vermont Arts Council grant to work on some of the larger singing pieces. So there's going to be lots of singing opportunities for people to get involved. And I'm very excited for Here in the Valley to get started again on that front. We also host a jam session every Wednesday at the filling station in White River Junction, and that's an acoustic jam session. So you can bring an acoustic instrument, and we play bluegrass and old time and folk and whatever anyone wants to sing. It's pretty eclectic, and some really great players come out. And so that's another event that we put on regularly. And then, the Tuesday jukebox, and just as things open up, hopefully more collaborations with other artists across the state. I'm really looking forward to getting out of our little bubble and bringing more cross-pollination, I guess.
Brooks Hubbard, you're back in the area after several years down in Nashville. You've got this show Friday in White River Junction. Do you go out on tour then, or you just hunker down for a while, stay here, and write more music?
Yeah, I think the rest of this year I'll be primarily up here in this area playing local gigs and stuff, and writing and working on some new material to put out next year. So I'm thinking next year will be a touring year, but it's been nice to, reestablish myself back here and gain my roots again. So.
Yeah, that is fantastic. And Jess, it feels like you're really kind of creating, I don't know, almost a bluegrass Americana type scene in White River Junction. Is that what you're working on with here in the Valley?
Yeah, that's the goal. I mean, those players are already here.
Yep.
But we were so lucky. There's such a wonderful bluegrass and scene on the West Coast, and we loved being a part of that, and it was hard to leave it. And so coming here, we found some great players, and we just feel like our role is connecting them and elevating them. And so that's what we're trying to do.
All right. So this Friday night, let's give people the details again, where it is, when it is, and how they can get tickets for the event.
Yeah, so the event is on Friday. You can get tickets easily at Here in the Valley. That's an easy one to remember. HereInTheValley.org. We have the ticket links right on the first page. You can get streaming tickets or in-person tickets right there. And there is a pretty good advantage to getting advance tickets. Advance tickets are $25, and in-person tickets are $35. So we're hoping that people will tell us they're coming in advance.
Love to hear that. And the music is absolutely beautiful from both bands. Jess Raymond is a member of Jess and Jacob. Brooks Hubbard of the Brooks Hubbard Band. That'll be both bands performing this Friday night, Briggs Opera House in White River Junction. And you can learn more, order tickets for the in-person or the streaming event at hereinthevalley.org. Want to thank both of you, Jess and Brooks, for being on this morning. And have a great show Friday night.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, get an update, and then we'll be back to learn why trees do what they do this time of year. Coming up today at 11, though, it's Bill Sayre with Common Sense Radio. How many times did I introduce Bill's show, and now I forgot it? Oh, and a reminder, tomorrow at noon, it's the Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference here on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. At this time of year, the big question is about where the fall foliage is reaching its peak. And as of a few days ago, that would have been along the spine of the Green Mountains in the higher elevations and up in the far northeastern corner of the state around Canaan. The more persistent, ageless question is, why do trees give this incredible show of color every year? Is it just to make us happy and to draw all those tourists from away so they can support our rural economy here in Vermont? That's one answer. Here to shed some light on the question and the answer is Abby Vandenberg, a research professor at UVM's Proctor Maple Research Center. Abby, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, to ask Abby questions about the changing colors of our leaves, you can call us 244-1777. 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Abby, do you still get excited for the fall to roll around and the leaves to change colors?
I honestly do. It is my favorite time of year. It never gets old.
It never gets old, right?
Absolutely not.
All right, good. I just want to make sure I wasn't the only one who can't grow out of this thing. Let's discuss leaves in general. Why do trees even have them in the first place?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, the reason leaves are there in the first place is essentially to make food for the trees. So leaves are there to capture sunlight and carbon dioxide and use the two to make fuel, sugar for the tree, either to use right then and there to stay alive or to store for later on. This is trees. Mm-hmm. Store for later on in subsequent years or in an annual plant. Leaves are there to those carbohydrates can be stored for later in the same year. But either way, they're there to make food for the tree.
So if leaves, the idea is to bring in as much sunlight as possible. Why aren't leaves black rather than green?
Why aren't leaves black?
I mean, darker colors absorb more, you know, heat and light, right?
Well, the main pigment that is responsible for absorbing the sunlight in leaves is chlorophyll, which is green. And it's actually green because it is reflecting most of the green light, and that's what we see. So trees have pigments that are, or sorry, leaves have pigments that are highly specialized to absorb particular wavelengths of sunlight that enable them to, that they can use maximally to harvest and store. And really, there is a balance between, you know, yes, they need to absorb sunlight, but they're just like any other organism. There are limits to what they can use. So you need, leaves need enough sunlight to do their job and to make fuel and make carbohydrates, but they also really can't handle too much. So too much sun, especially if there's also not a lot, enough water to go with it, for example, too much sun can be really damaging for leaves. So they can't overdo it.
Oh, interesting. Just like humans. Yeah. So how is light converted into nutrients for the tree?
Basically, chlorophyll absorbs the light energy, and some of the energy from that, and try not to get too complicated.
I understand.
Yeah. Some of that light energy is transferred and used to power the process of converting the carbon dioxide that's also being absorbed by the leaves to fix that into molecules of carbohydrate. So sunlight is really the energy that is used to power that process.
All right. So at what point does chlorophyll just walk off the job every year?
You would be really surprised to know this, but when you are looking at leaves and trees in particular carefully, leaves generally in this part of the world stop making new chlorophyll around midsummer. So basically, around the time of July 1st-ish, leaves will stop making new chlorophyll. And then toward the end of the summer, so as the day lengths begin to shorten, that then the existing chlorophyll begins to break down.
All right. So you'd think that leaves might have evolved to find, like, another way to convert sunlight as the days grew shorter or colder, or to keep, you know, making new chlorophyll. But that's not the case. Any reason why it just, you know, doesn't produce more chlorophyll?
Well, it is the case in evergreen trees, trees that keep their leaves all year long. So it's very specifically deciduous trees that have evolved a strategy to kind of, they go all in and then all out. They are going to take that, they're going to stop producing that chlorophyll, reabsorb as many of the nutrients as possible that are in those leaves, and they're super efficient about doing that. They don't leave much, and then shed those leaves. And there are a variety of reasons for doing that. And one of them is, you know, in this part of the world, I've heard, you know, people tell me that it snows a lot here. So, and we've all seen probably over the years certain instances where we have a very early snowfall, an early snowfall in the fall when the leaves are still on the trees.
Yep.
And you've probably seen, many of your listeners have probably seen firsthand the kind of devastation that that can cause when snow or ice falls on existing leaves. It can really, really cause a lot of damage for trees. So that's one of the reasons that broadleaf tree species have evolved to have this period of deciduousness where they shed those leaves and then start all over again in the spring.
Oh, that's brilliant. Oh, these trees are smarter than I thought. Now, Abby, where does the color that we see in the fall in the leaves come from?
It actually comes from two different processes. So which is kind of, to me, is part really amazing. So step one, as we already talked about, the existing chlorophyll in the leaf, what we see as green, begins to be broken down and reabsorbed and recycled by the tree. So, you know, there's a lot of nitrogen. It's a really, chlorophyll is a really nutrient-rich compound. So a lot of that is getting reabsorbed into the tree to get stored for the next year's growth. And so what we see first in most tree species, what we see is basically the yellow pigments, the accessory pigments that exist in the leaf all year round, things called carotenoids, these are actually revealed once that chlorophyll begins to break down. Normally, that yellow coloration is masked by the intensity of the chlorophyll that's there. But once that chlorophyll begins to be reduced, then we can see those carotenoids, those yellow pigments, and sometimes orange, that have been there all along. We just haven't been able to see them. So that's step one, and that kind of makes sense. You know, we're revealing something that was already there, part of the process that just sort of kind of it's sensical. The other part of the process, which some but not all deciduous tree species take part in, is the actual production of new pigments. So most of the red colors that we see in, like, maple trees, or even the purple colors that we see in species like ash, those are actually new pigments called anthocyanins that are synthesized brand new during the process. While the rest of the leaf is kind of packing it in and getting ready to die, it's also making these new pigments. So that are, you know, especially here in the Northeast, we are really, you know, we get the benefit of seeing a lot of those brilliant reds that we see red maples make, those purples, like I mentioned, with the ash trees. So that is a totally newly synthesized pigment that's going on at that time. And so we see the combination of those two processes together at this time of year.
Doesn't that seem counterintuitive for a tree to make new pigments, to exert that energy at a time when it's pulling in energy and storing?
It seems it doesn't even seem counterintuitive. It is completely counterintuitive, and it's why people have tried for years to figure out, well, why in the heck do they do that? It must make some kind of broader ecological sense. So as we think of it, you know, there must be some net benefit to it. Otherwise, it would have been, or at least no net negative to it.
Right.
Otherwise, that trait would have been not selected for over evolutionary history. But here it persists.
This is brings me back to my point that trees are doing this to draw tourists to Vermont to stimulate our economy. It's not ecological, it's economical.
That is a reasonable hypothesis. We are all part of the same ecosystem.
Thank you. Let's go to the phones. We've got Forbes. Hey, Forbes.
Hi. Good morning. How are you?
Great. What's up?
I've been fortunate enough to have worked on trees for about 35 years and some observations. I'll get a call where a tree has died for no apparent reason. And when I go out and talk to the people, I ask them, what have you done with the tree? Have you fertilized this tree? And, oh, yes, we put it on. Well, they put it on late. And, of course, what happened is the tree that's normally supposed to go into dormancy, and I usually figure around August 15th, it starts its decline. It stays activated and winds up freezing. It doesn't go into dormancy because of the added fertilizer, and the tree is spiked with growth when it shouldn't be. Camel's hump was a classic example of the trees up there that were poisoned because they were being foliar fed. And the last question I do have is, when you cut a tree down near the stump end or the butt end log, there are rings in the tree. And if you count those rings, can you actually judge approximate age of the tree?
All right. Great questions, Forbes. Let's start with the idea of fertilizing too late in a season and when it should be going dormant. What does that do, Abby, to a tree?
Actually, not super well knowledgeable in that particular area. I know that it can be damaging, but I think it may be species and context specific. So
okay.
I don't necessarily want to speak to that directly.
All right. Sorry about that, Forbes. Cutting a tree, counting the rings, is that a myth or is that truth that we can actually count how old a tree is using that method?
That is absolutely true, although it can be a little difficult, especially with a species like maple. Some species have a tendency to make false rings or have rings that are very difficult to see, like maple. But in general, yes, in many species, you are able to count the rings to see how old the tree was, and also to look at the size of the ring to see how it was growing. You can tell years that maybe there was a drought or an insect outbreak and there wasn't much growth at all. Tree rings can really tell us a lot about the life of the tree.
Mm. Let's go to Ann next. Hi, Ann. You ready? We ready to go? She's from Brookfield. Hold on. Let's get Ann up there. Ann, you ready?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Abby, yes, I was wondering, do you ever come to
turn your radio down,
organizations,
Ann.
To different organizations and tell them about trees? Like at DAR, we need speakers at times, just, you know, like 20 minutes or half an hour speech. Do you ever do that?
All right.
Absolutely. I love talking to anyone that's interested about trees and the research that we do here, whether that's fall coloration or maple production, which is the majority of my research is related to maple production, maple trees and maple production. So, yes, you can send me an email. My email address is on the UVM Proctor Maple Research Center website, and I would be happy to do that.
All right. And there you go, speaker for an upcoming DAR meeting. That sounds great. Abby, will the same tree's leaves turn the same color each year?
Yes and no. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It is, you know, there are some trees that turn exactly the same color, at seemingly exactly the same time each year, and then other times you'll see a lot of variation from year to year. Sometimes that's species specific, sometimes it's location specific. But in general, there's sort of a consistent general pattern for a particular tree growing in a particular location that may deviate a little bit from year to year depending on growing conditions and things like that. Or if something drastic happens, like you have a forest tree that suddenly every other tree around it was removed and it's got lots of sun exposure and it's kind of stressed out, then you could see some major differences.
All right, let's go to another caller. We got Doug now joining us from Randolph. Hi, Doug. Go right ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Love the subject. There's a theory that when the sap won't run in the spring, when the wind is coming out of the south, and I've always wondered if it weren't because the tree was being bent in a direction to shut off the sap flow.
All right. Abby, you've probably heard that before, these different myths of you know, sap flow in the spring. When the wind comes out of the south, does it have an effect? And is it because of what Doug said?
Well, we have all heard that, or anyone that's involved in sugaring has heard that, and there is, in a way, some truth to that, or there can be some truth to that, because oftentimes it is the temperature of the fine branches in the tree, and also the trunk as well, but that can really affect, it's important what the temperature inside the tree is, which determines how much the pressure, the actual above atmospheric pressure that is generated in the tree, how high that is. So if the wind is cold and sort of cooling those surfaces off, it can actually have a sort of a reducing effect on sap flow, especially under gravity conditions, you know, when we're not adding vacuum to supplement that pressure differential. So it's, yes, it can be true when it's from the south, but in general it is anytime we have a sort of evaporative cooling to the surfaces of the tree can reduce the sap flow that we see under gravity conditions, but it's mostly due to a temperature reduction, not kind of any compression on the inside or something like that.
Well, Abby, let's stay at that time of year. Is there anything, do we know, you know, if something happens, weather conditions in the spring or early summer, how that will affect the colorful or not colorful fall foliage season?
That is a really good question, and the answer is it's super complex, and it's similar to what we see with questions related to sap sugar concentration for sugaring. The colors and what happens, yes, they absolutely can and are affected by the growing conditions of our trees. what gets complex is that it can be affected not only by the conditions in the growing season before, but also it's affected in very many nuanced ways by the conditions as the autumn unfolds itself. And then it's also affected by conditions that the tree experienced maybe the year before or the year before or the year before. It gets rather complex to kind of tease out. But generally speaking, anything that tends to promote stress for the tree, so a little bit of stress, we tend to see that reflected in possibly a little bit of an early timing for the beginning of fall senescence, or that the beginning of the fall coloration process. Mm. And it can be associated with more of the anthocyanin and the brilliant red production. And the kind of tying link is there, those red pigments, those anthocyanins. Now, we've done a lot of research to try and figure out, well, what the heck are they doing in these leaves that are about to be shed? In other leaves, leaves during the growing season or other structures, so those red pigments are found everywhere from stems to leaf stems, those petioles to seeds. One of the common threads of when they occur transiently in plants is our conditions of stress. So there's always been sort of at least a loose theoretical, hypothetical linkage between a little bit of stress and a little bit of an enhanced fall color production.
All right. Well, we got about a minute left. Do you have favorite spots to leaf peep?
My favorite spots are no favorite spot. I've been doing this yep. for a little while. I'm not going to say how long, but in my experience, what I found is that it always pays to hit the road.
Yeah.
And if you do some exploring, you will be surprised each year when and where you have your annual take your breath away moment. So that would be my recommendation, is to get out there and explore and find that one spot for this year.
Yeah, what a brilliant suggestion. And thank you so much. Wow, this was so great. So much good information. Abby Vandenberg is a research professor at UVM's Proctor Maple Research Center. You can learn more about their work at uvm.edu. Abby, thank you so much. What a great show. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me.
Oh, absolutely. All right, that is our show for today, Vermont Viewpoint, directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. And the Vermont Viewpoint podcast is sponsored by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. Tomorrow, I'll have Vermont State College's Chancellor Sophie Zadatny on. And don't forget, we also have tomorrow at noon the governor's COVID-19 response news conference. That is tomorrow. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.